What happened in Dillingham is not just a problem for the city of Dillingham. It's a problem for all of us.
A public outcry over an animal cruelty case in Dillingham. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 5th of January. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new federal permitting system for halibut charter boats.
Well, this is quite frankly yet another one of the Death by a Thousand Cuts initiatives that we can point our fingers to.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
Last month's tragedy at the Dillingham Animal Shelter, where six dogs died while in the care of the city, will result in criminal charges. Animal rights activists hope the incident will help make the case for stronger laws to prevent animal cruelty. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
The death of the six dogs at the city's animal shelter in downtown Dillingham was discovered on December 8th after the police department was tipped off by maintenance personnel with the city that something was amiss at the animal shelter. A synopsis of the incident was prepared by then-Police Chief Richard Thompson, and that synopsis was apparently leaked to the Anchorage Daily News, which ran an article about the incident over the weekend. Assistant District Attorney Susan Mitchell confirms that she will be filing criminal charges related to the incident at the animal shelter.
The information that appeared in the Anchorage Daily News was part of a police report that police reports are confidential until the district attorney's office makes a decision as to whether or not to make them public. I don't think the person that leaked it to the Anchorage Daily News understood that.
Mitchell says she will file misdemeanor animal cruelty charges later this week, but she wouldn't confirm who those charges would be filed against, but it's believed that they will be filed against Community Service Officer Travis Barnett, who was in charge of caring for the animals in the shelter. Barnett has refused to answer questions about the incident and has been suspended pending the completion of the investigation and the legal process. The official cause of death for the six dogs found in the animal shelter was starvation and dehydration. However, hypothermia was also a contributing factor in the death of at least one dog. The veterinarian who performed the necropsies on the six dead dogs was Jim Hagee, who runs Hagee Veterinary Service in Chugiak. Hagee has routinely made trips to Dillingham for the last 6 years. He says there's the potential to use the incident at the animal shelter as a springboard for improvements as to how stray and lost animals are dealt with in the city of Dillingham.
I did talk to Dr. Myra Wilson, who is the chief veterinarian at the Animal Control Center here in Anchorage, and she offered to come out, and I believe that she has talked with Chief Thompson about what needs to be done, what can be done as far as improving the animal welfare out there and assuring this never happens again.
The report from Hagee was not supposed to be released to the media, but it was, and KDLG News got a copy of the report, which documents that at least one of the dogs resorted to cannibalism in an attempt to live. Hagee says that neglect ultimately caused the demise of the six dogs. The incident has prompted a response from the Alaska Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. Sally Clampett is the organization's executive director, and she says it's an obvious open and shut case of animal cruelty and should be promptly and aggressively prosecuted as such by the state of Alaska to the fullest extent of the law.
What happened in Dillingham, in my personal opinion, is not just a problem for the city of Dillingham. It's a problem for all of us, not just because of fiscal responsibility, but because we as a society have a moral obligation to work together and not have these kinds of things happen.
Not only is Clampett suggesting that charges be brought against Travis Barnett, but in a written statement she suggests that charges be levied against any other staff who were in line to assume responsibility for the dogs. Clampett says the incident at the Dillingham Animal Shelter might spark a re-examination of the animal cruelty laws in Alaska.
The most recent changes to the state statute provided that animal cruelty is a felony, but not until the third conviction. And there is legislation being presented this year at this session that would change the three strikes and you're out, so that it's just a felony on the first conviction. And we support that. Why should someone be allowed to do this three times?
The city's animal shelter has been closed, and a temporary shelter has been set up at the Dillingham Police Department. Alice Ruby is the mayor of Dillingham, and she has been surprised by many of the comments that came her way after the Anchorage Daily News article was published over the weekend.
The city of Dillingham and the residents in Dillingham are all, we you know, think as much of our animals as we do of our residents, and we know that, and we know that people hold the city in a trust position in the case of a shelter.
The incident at the animal shelters already prompted some action by the city of Dillingham, including beginning the process of developing a written animal control and shelter operations policy and soliciting animal shelter services from an independent provider. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
The federal government will start limiting the number of halibut charter boats in Alaska next year. The National Marine Fisheries Service yesterday announced it will require the charter operators to obtain a federal permit. KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports.
The National Marine Fisheries Service says the new limited entry program is meant to stabilize the growing southeast and south central halibut charter fishing sector, which has exceeded federal guideline harvest levels for several years. Rachel Baker is a fisheries analyst with NIMS.
The number of vessels that had participated in recent years, really since about 2004, had increased. There had been sort of a gradual increase, and so the intent was to limit the number of vessels that could participate in order to sort of limit that growth.
The program will require the charter businesses to obtain a permit from NIMS during a one-time 60-day application period. NIMS has not yet set that schedule, but the agency says it could begin as soon as next month. In order to qualify, Baker says an individual or business will need to have conducted documented charters in certain years.
The first qualification period is 2004 or 2005. Participation would be required in one of those years. The applicant will be able to select which one based on their individual participation. And then the second qualification period is 2008.
NIMS estimates that some 43% of the southeast halibut charter fleet and 34% of south central halibut charter businesses would not qualify for the permit. NIMS projects it will issue around 502 permits for the southeast region and another 418 for south central. Baker says NIMS estimates there would still be enough halibut charter operators to meet current angler demand and maybe allow for some future growth.
We don't think, based on what we've seen, that this limited access program would by itself reduce charter halibut harvest.
Not unexpectedly, the limited entry program is garnering mixed reviews from the commercial and charter fleets, which have been engaged in a long-standing debate over halibut catches. John Blair is the executive director of the Southeast Alaska Guides Organization, SEGO. Blair says a charter fleet has been unfairly blamed for declining halibut numbers in Alaska.
This plan was implemented in response to accusations of out-of-control charter growth, when in fact, for the past 3 years, actually since 2006, industry participation by the guided charter industry has been flat, and certainly in 2009 we saw a dramatic decrease. Frankly, we caught 50% fewer fish than the year before.
Between the one halibut bag limit imposed last summer in Southeast and the limited entry system, Blair says the halibut charter industry has been hit hard by new federal regulations.
Well, this is quite frankly yet another one of the death by a thousand cuts initiatives that we can point our fingers to. No single initiative on its own has been the proverbial final nail. However, cumulatively, the impact has been dire.
Both the charter and commercial industries had expected the limited entry program to be implemented this year. Jeff Shelton has worked as a commercial halibut fisherman for 50 years. He says a limited entry system for the halibut charter fleet is necessary and long past due.
For the last 5 years, the council has attempted to establish a limit on the catch from the charter fleet without actively controlling permits or anything else. And those efforts have been for naught because the catch in the charter fleet has exceeded the council's recommendations and the council's levels. significantly every year.
And those charter overages have been a source of frustration for Southeast longliners like Shelton, who have seen their catch limits drop by more than 50% in the last few years. Details of the new limited entry program for the halibut charter industry are available online at alaskafisheries.noaa.gov. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new approach to boosting student achievement in Southeast.
If a reading series doesn't work, putting it in the attic and buying another reading series may not be the answer.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
Fairbanks air quality has been horrible in recent weeks. The federal fine particulate pollution standard was exceeded on 19 days in December and has done so every day so far this month. Borough air quality technician Jim McCormick says smoke from wood burning and atmospheric conditions are combining to degrade local air.
It's the inversion, the cold air on the ground with the warmer air above. The pollutants just get trapped close to the ground. And apparently there are a lot more people burning wood and green wood.
McCormick says recent conditions have been the worst since 2008, when the Environmental Protection Agency tightened the fine particulate standard from 65 micrograms per cubic meter to 35. McCormick says Fairbanks would have been in violation on only 5 days last month under the old standard. The borough monitors air quality in several spots in Fairbanks and North Pole. McCormick says particulates are primarily an urban problem.
The pollutants tend to be worse within the city areas where there's a lot of homes. And once you get above the inversion level in the hills, it tends to get much better.
Borough air quality technician Todd Thompson handles public complaints about smoke. Thompson says he's been fielding a constant stream of concerns.
The last couple 2 to 3 weeks since we've had these strong inversions, you know, we're getting anywhere from 2 to 5 calls a day during the week, and over the weekend too, we get quite a few calls that we just can't get to all the time. So it's been quite a few more phone calls this year at this time than in the past couple of years.
Thompson says some people suspect there's illegal burning going on.
There've been complaints of people saying that it smells caustic and toxic, and that they think someone might be burning something other than wooden coal in their neighborhood, but we've never found a source that was actually an illegal burn.
Thompson says the borough assesses particulate levels with a mobile sniffer unit. Individual site readings have been more than 1,000 micrograms per cubic meter, worse than those measured during heavy wildfire smoke conditions. The borough is working to come up with a range of measures to clean up local air to meet federal fine particulate pollution standards. State troopers are investigating the shooting death of a swan near Sitka over the weekend. The incident was likely a violation of both state and federal wildlife laws. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Fish and Wildlife Trooper Kyle Carson says the swan had apparently been shot with a small caliber firearm. Carson says the bird had not been dead more than a day or two when it was reported to troopers. He believes the bird could have been killed from either a boat or a car. He thinks it's possible that the swan could have been shot upstream along the Nelson logging road and then drifted to salt water. Both tundra and trumpeter swans migrate through and occasionally winter in Sitka. Carson has not identified this particular swan. He says it was a juvenile with about a 3-foot wingspan. There is no hunting season for swans in Southeast Alaska. In fact, they're protected by the Federal Migratory Bird Treaty Act. Gary Young is an agent with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Anchorage. He says the penalty for violating the act is $15,000 or 6 months in jail, or both. Young says most people who take pot shots at birds don't realize the risk they're taking with the law.
In the case of birds, with the exception of just a very few, all birds are protected as migratory by federal laws. So people aren't always aware of that, and sometimes they are surprised when they do find that out. But just because it's a game bird, whether it's a duck or a swan, or a non-game bird like a hawk or even a raven, they are all protected by federal law and the Migratory Bird Treaty Act.
Solving the case is likely to prove challenging. In February of 2006, a trumpeter swan was killed on Swan Lake in downtown Sitka. Both federal and state authorities investigated the case. Area residents concerned about the crime started a special fund to support the investigation, but the two leading suspects in the incident were never charged, and the case remains open. Gary Young says law enforcement will require assistance in this case, too.
More often than not, that we need help from the general public or some person with a specific knowledge about who may have shot this bird or any bird on an unsolved case. There are so very few of the wildlife enforcement officers, whether they're state troopers or fish and wildlife agents, that we just don't have enough people to be everywhere.
State wildlife troopers in Sitka can be reached at 747-3254. The carcass of the swan will be retained as evidence. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
With the holiday food temptations and parties pretty much over, a lot of people are now pursuing resolutions seeking weight loss, better physical fitness, and a more active lifestyle. Yesterday, the Better Business Bureau Office for Alaska issued a warning to health-seeking consumers to make certain their desire for physical fitness doesn't result in financial injury. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Glutted with seasonal goodies, prompted by straining belts and stretching seams, many of us are entering January 2010 with New Year's resolutions proclaiming our intention to become healthier. According to Tara Sims of the Better Business Bureau, that's precisely what some corrupt companies are counting upon.
We just want consumers to know that misleading companies are out there, and they will try to take advantage of things that are in the news or current events, such as New Year's resolutions.
Sims works in the Better Business Bureau's Anchorage office. She says consumers wanting to shed pounds should beware of certain red flags.
If you see anything touting it's a miracle pill and you don't need diet or exercise, be very cautious. If you're seeing any type of enticing advertisements, say they're very urgent and there's a limited time offer and you need to sign up. For example, we see these a lot of times online. You'll click on the website. It'll say you have 5 minutes to sign up for this offer or you can't get the deal. And a lot of times consumers sign up and realize later that every single time you go to that website, that same alert comes up.
That's particularly true of advertised inducements like drop 3 sizes in 1 week or lose 30 pounds in 2 weeks. Sim says be even more suspicious when wondrous claims are coupled to free offers.
Supplement sellers out there have been touting free trial offers, and then consumers go ahead and sign up for this free trial offer, but they don't read all the terms and conditions and find out later that you have to cancel that free trial offer by a certain deadline. And if you don't cancel by that deadline, you end up paying a monthly charge, and it can vary in price between $20 to $75 a month, depending on the supplement.
Sims has similar advice for anyone about to sign contracts with fitness centers, health clubs, and trainers. Carefully read the agreement before signing and discuss various options.
A warning to consumers to educate themselves. Make sure that if you're going to sign up for a gym membership or a health club membership, to inspect the membership contract thoroughly. Don't just sign off on anything. Find out how long the contract's going to be for, what the cancellation policy is if you end up in any financial trouble and decide you want to cancel your membership. Just things like that to look into when you're signing that contract.
She says there are some online resources fitness-seeking consumers can use. First of all, anyone doing business in Alaska is required to be licensed, and nutritionists and dietitians must have special professional licensing from the state. There are also additional tips at www.fitness.gov and the National Institute of Health offers information through the Office of Dietary Supplements website. To find out about any complaints lodged by consumers against a fitness, nutritional, or supplement business, Sims suggests going to BBB.org for reliability reports.
It's just a good idea to do some research about the company, the offer being advertised, and make sure and get a BBB reliability report on the company as well. And it'll save you a lot of money in the end.
And of course, it's also a good idea to consult with your physician before starting any new exercise, nutritional, or supplemental regimes. This is Len Anderson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Communication Systems, keeping Alaska connected with solutions for small businesses that manage your company's voice and data systems so you can focus on running your business. ACSAlaska.com.
A company that had its modest beginnings in Eagle River a dozen years ago and grew to more than $100 million in revenue in 2009 was just purchased by Cook Inlet Region Incorporated, or CIRI, a South Central Alaska Native corporation. Northwind Incorporated was started by Sylvia Medina in Eagle River in 1997 and now has its main headquarters in Idaho Falls, Idaho. The company specializes in environmental cleanup work, engineering, and construction for federal contracts with the Department of Defense and Energy. Greg Razzo is Vice President of Government Contracting for CIRI. He says Northwind began as an environmental remediation services company with a focus on nuclear waste.
So the Department of Energy is a key customer to Northwind, and other large prime contractors like Bechtel are important customers for Northwind. And this Department of Energy sophisticated type of remediation activity is an area where there isn't a significant amount of competition from other Alaska Native corporations.
Razzo says Northwind does cleanup work at Hanford Nuclear Reservation in Washington State, Los Alamos Laboratory in New Mexico, and at the Idaho National Laboratory.
Where historically there's been research and development in nuclear engineering, development of weapons for the U.S. government, and consequently along with those sorts of developments, there's a resulting environmental consequence. And Northwind is a company that deals with that sort of high-level nuclear cleanup as one of its business activities.
Razzo says the company has about 400 employees, 19 offices throughout the U.S., and currently operates about 325 project contracts. He says Northwind does other types of business beyond cleanup work.
It has business activity in IT. It also has business activity in characterization of natural and cultural resources. So it's a fairly full-service company, and it's the kind of company that has enough different business units that we can simply lend serious financial strength to expand those business units and grow Northwind.
Razzo says there are only about a dozen Northwind employees in Alaska currently, but he expects that number to grow. He says work they're doing for private companies has good growth potential in Alaska, possibly cleaning up oil spills. CIRI is not planning any management changes or staff cuts. The purchase price of the company was not disclosed. A Southeast Alaska cultural organization is releasing a series of books it hopes will increase student success rates. Sea Alaska Heritage Institute is presenting the books and what's called the Developmental Language Process to educators in four of the region's communities. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports from Juneau.
Kids don't always learn the way we like to think they do. Here's how longtime educator Jim McDermott puts it.
In the past, the assumption has been that during the actual lessons of instruction, the kids are putting academic language into their long-term memories. Well, test results are showing that a lot of the kids are not doing that, so that when we test them, which is, of course, language, they, in fact, fail. And often, it has nothing to do with specifically with the knowledge. It has to do with language.
And when kids fall behind in their language skills, they can fall behind in most everything else. McDermott says it's a common problem for native students who have lower test scores and higher dropout rates in many school districts.
For a language-delayed student to succeed is very, very difficult because they can't read with comprehension the textbooks that are given to them. And because of the language delay, they have more difficulty acquiring new information.
McDermott is curriculum director for the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute and an advocate of what's called the developmental language process. The Institute recently released a series of books describing how educators can use the process to communicate better with their students. The books offer exercises, games, and other activities aimed at helping students improve their language skills.
It has taken a while for not just Alaska, but some parts of North America, Canada, to realize if a reading series doesn't work, putting it in the attic and buying another reading series may not be the answer. That maybe we need to look at a process that can be used with whatever the teachers already have. These aren't separate curricula. These are resource materials that teachers can use to develop academic language with the kids in science, in math, in social studies, and also heritage language.
The Institute has already used the approach in training some Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian language instructors, and it plans on demonstrating what the books advocate during sessions in Juneau, Ketchikan, Hoonah, and Heidelberg. Officials at several districts said they're interested, but did not want to comment until they reviewed the materials and attended the trainings. McDermott says the language instruction is an important part of the Institute's approach, but he does not expect it to create fluent native speakers.
If it does nothing more than to give the kids an awareness of the sophistication of the languages and the cultures and the depth to, you know, of these cultures and language, and of course to acquire as much of communication language as they can, then it's succeeded.
The Heritage Institute's approach builds on a number of earlier efforts aimed at making education more relevant to Native students. One is the Axe Handle curriculum, which focuses on regional studies, comparative culture, and communication. Another is the Total Physical Response Method, which uses similar word and action exercises to anchor language in long-term memory. The books were funded through a grant from the Alaska Native Education Program. They're available online through the Institute's website. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
The Alaska Volcano Observatory is lowering the alert level on Readout Volcano from yellow to green. Scientists say seismic activity at the volcano is low and there aren't any visible signs of unrest. A swarm of earthquakes a week ago prompted the observatory to raise the alert level. Readout erupted last spring. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Mike Mason in Dillingham, Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Len Anderson in Anchorage, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Dave Waldron and Kristen Spack. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
And by
GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.